when you got into movies, that those early films, the pre-Easy Rider films, the Roger Corman movies, do they make you wince when you see them on television now?
Well, they all make you wince. I mean, I think work of any vintage, because, you know, you embody your own work, makes anyone wince, or at least it should. I got to do a few things that I actually liked, and I must say that although I was in some of the most dreadful pictures of all time, that I was, and so were all the people I was working with, trying to do their best under the circumstances, and that's really all you need as a developing actor, is just to be trying to do it well. If you can live with the humiliation of, you know, being in something where it's pretty funny, you know, it's not bad for you. I always have felt that I was lucky, because if I had been successful that early, I'd be in a position where I was trying to make a comeback now.
Welcome to Speak All Evil, the podcast you were warned about. I'm Trent, here with Kevin, Kat, and Dave. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Hi.
Everybody's back. We're back in the studio.
Woo!
Feels good.
Yeah, it's been a while.
I haven't seen anything other than the movies that we're talking about this week. Haven't had a chance. I've been sick. And frankly, these took up a bit of my time, since one of them is 2 hours. One of them feels like 4 hours. I don't know if you guys, anybody see anything besides what we're going to talk about?
I watched the movie that a scene from the first movie we're going to talk about is in.
Oh, you watched Targets?
No.
Oh.
I watched Avenged.
Okay.
So, like, Avenged, it's like 2013 or something, I think.
Oh. Huh.
It's called Redsploitation.
So Redsploitation.
It's basically like Native American horror.
Oh, okay.
But it's basically like I did not make that word up. It's basically the Redsploitation version of I Spit on Your Grave.
Gotcha.
But kind of like, you know, like Night of the Living Dead is playing in the background of like 1,000 movies. For some reason, the ending of this movie is playing in that movie.
Huh.
So when I saw that on like Wikipedia or something, I was like, oh, that's on Tubi as well.
How was it?
It's pretty good, actually.
Yeah?
It's uneven. It's like very independent. I mean, it looks great. But I mean, as far as like movie, like if you go to Tubi, it's just going to recommend, okay, you want to watch I Spit on Your Grave next, and you want to watch like all those types of flicks. So it has that element to it. A little action-y, pretty good gore, actually. You could tell it's from a bunch of indie gore dudes, but yeah.
My viewing experience was very, very scary. I watched Elvis and Priscilla back to back.
Ooh.
But while flying through the air on an airplane.
Wow, and Elvis died in an airplane.
The cheapest airplane possible. The cheapest one you could possibly get, the lowest
Spirit.
Ticket. I just went for the lowest price, mm-hmm. The whole family get on. That was scary.
How were the movies? Elvis is the one with Tom Hanks as Colonel Tom Parker, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, they were entertaining on the plane. The thing I don't like is when I watch things that I want to watch on the plane, I think you've talked about this before, Kevin, is you have too much peripheral viewing from everyone around.
Way too much.
So you even have a 5-second sex scene. It is devastating.
Yes.
Kat, you seen anything good?
I was moving all weekend, so in my spare time I watched like Next Level Chef.
Nice.
Great television show. Great program. No,
I don't know, you got a new TV.
Yeah, I got a new TV.
Kat has an 85-inch TV.
Woo.
Wow.
Some would say too big for a living room.
And just to be clear, when you're saying moving, you just moved up to the next set of steps above your apartment.
So I moved up and over.
All these things you canceled. I'm moving. Sorry, I got to
move.
What
did I cancel, Dave? What did I cancel? You tell me what I canceled. I'd love to hear about
it. I was projecting how I am when I have to move.
Like, I mean, it wasn't... It's not ready for human view yet, but here I am having people over to my apartment to watch wrestling.
On an 85-inch screen.
You know what? Yeah, I do baby. Take it back. I watched Sting's last match.
Oh.
Before he retired.
Oh, wow.
On Sunday. So.
Did he do the Scorpion leg lock? Is that it? Am I right?
Sure. Yeah. Probably.
Yeah, I think that's it.
I think that's
maybe.
It.
Darby Allin, his tag team partner, did a real jump onto actual glass, like a glass pane, and his whole back was just covered in blood. He was covered in blood. Everyone was cheering and happy. Yeah, so that happened. So horror in real life, I guess.
Between this podcast and your soon-to-be marriage, mm-hmm. you really see a lot of stuff these days.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. I see it all, pal. It's great. I love it.
This week, it's Jack Nicholson week, but yeah. not The Shining.
We covered that too early in the podcast.
Jack Nicholson horror movies that aren't The Shining.
You
may
think?
Not be aware that yeah. there are other horror movies that star Jack Nicholson.
I think there's only two.
Kat dug up the only two she could find, which would explain our first film from 1963 called The Terror.
Lieutenant Duvalier, a French soldier, loses contact with his unit and is forced to wander alone near the Baltic Sea. While in search of his regiment, he spies Helene, a mysterious beauty, walking by herself. Mesmerized, Duvalier begins tracking her, but she vanishes. He later catches up with her and follows her into a castle, where he encounters the bizarre Baron von Lepp, finds signs of witchcraft, and maybe even learns the shocking truth about Helene. I wouldn't say that this is an action-packed thrill ride of a film.
No.
But I thought the story in itself was fun. And you've got the sweetest little Jack Nicholson I ever did see. His little voice is so high and soft, and I was just like, oh, who is this man? I've never met him before. This is great. So pure. He was just like trying to rescue this like this phantom woman. I was like, okay, you go, little Jack. I love that for you. I would say this one dragged a bit for me, even though it was only a little over an hour long.
Hour and 20 minutes. Longest hour 20.
Yeah. It was a bit long. It said an hour 15, and I was like, is it? Okay. But, you know, I was like, okay, what's going to happen now? Who's this guy? I didn't really understand the differences between a lot of characters, but maybe that's on me. It was definitely a stark dissimilarity to the other film this week in terms of like pacing and action and stuff like that. But that didn't make me hate it. Once you get into the meat and potatoes of the plot, I think things start to unravel, and then I was interested in what was going on. One thing that might have hindered my viewing of this film is what I mentioned before, is the 85-inch television that I watched it on, in which the clarity of the film is not great. It looks very pixelated, very rough. So I would suggest watching this. How big is the screen? 55 inches? Like maybe like a 50-inch and below television, your telephone. I maybe just should have watched it on my phone. But that's not the film's fault that my fiance decided to buy an 85-inch television. It's Nick's fault. Video quality aside, it's an interesting story. I think it holds up to today's spooky tales. It's got an Edgar Allan Poe vibe for sure. I was very into that. We don't get really any gore, but we do get the final scene to wrap it up, which I think for the time was probably an impressive effect of some meltingness. So I thought that was kind of cool. But yeah, I think this was a great classic film. Kevin?
Thanks, Kat. Back to you. I think Trent really instilled this spirit in me that I did not have, or it was not awoken when he did like The Wolfman and Creature from the Black Lagoon. And I realized that those are pretty big name like classics. I'm very underserved on this era of film and Roger Corman. I mean, we have to talk about the fact that this is a Corman production. We talk about Corman all the time,
but we
don't really delve all the way back into the 60s.
We're not usually talking about his
people,
hands-on
yeah, the way that we talk about him, people are probably thinking like 80s and a lot of that era. And we tend to talk about like Corman acolytes and disciples.
Everybody worked under Corman at some point.
And this is, so this movie to me is like The Ramones recorded an album. They left. They left all their gear there. They left the board set up. And then another band walked into the studio and just started making an album without having any songs written. Because your synopsis actually made a ton of sense.
Thank you.
But then later you said, when the story really gets going, I was interested. I was fucking lost. Mm. I was stopping. This movie took me like 2.5 hours to watch because I kept pausing it and rewinding and being like, who the fuck is this new guy stumbling around like mm-hmm. on the shore? And who? Wait, what just happened? And mm-hmm. why does Boris Karloff keep showing up? It's very, very confusing. Mm-hmm. And then when you read about the making of it, it makes total sense. I appreciated that. I actually yeah. really enjoyed knowing how this movie was made and watching it. And I can take a 25-year-old Jack Nicholson all day long. It's super fun to see, just like we talked about Corman, same thing with Nicholson. Like, you tend to sort of The Shining, and then you go forward. I've never seen Jack Nicholson, maybe One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or something, but like, this is like super young, early role Jack Nicholson. And I do like the gothic tale vibe of it. I don't know if I've ever talked about on the show, but like, maybe less movies, but literature. I'm a gothic tale sucker. Like,
yeah.
I'll do it all day long. I love it. I don't think it's always like, if there's a good gothic tale translated to screen, it instantly jumps into like my top 100 films. But as far as reading and things like that, and I do like the attempt here at originality towards a Poe-inspired gothic tale. Everything else is real bad. I mean, you can literally tell that these actors have no idea. They don't even know what's going on. They can't sell a scene or a plot because even they must have been handed this.
There wasn't
like
one
5 minutes.
Yeah.
5 minutes before, they must have been handed like a script or something. But I mean, again, Nicholson, Boris Karloff, and then I'm like, is that Dick Miller? Like, I'm literally like, it took me half the movie to be like, that is Dick Miller. Like,
yes.
Holy shit. But yeah, I mean, it was fun. I'm not mad at it. I appreciate the fact that I saw it. I will always like take any excuse to be driven to see a film from this era, definitely with the amount of people involved. But you know, it is kind of a big shit stain of a film overall. But you know. Dave, on to you.
In other news, this was like if my grandfather made me watch a movie mm-hmm. and he like held me and like suffocated me on his lap.
Clockwork Orange stuff. Yeah,
and he's just like, this is what horror movies are. And he's all drunk and breathing in my face. Aww. And or it's just something that I'd suffer through, creature double feature. Every once in a while, something like this would come on. And I didn't like it. I didn't know. He'd open one door and go through it, and it would be a totally different place than it was before. And I was so confused about even just the layout of everything. When it first came on, I like actually cheered because I loved like the fake bird
yes.
and some bad lightning. And I was like, yes. oh, this looks cool.
Same.
Like
yeah.
Hammer films and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then it was just meandering from thing to thing.
Yeah.
I did appreciate the random as hell eyes plucked out. No motive, nothing, just some violence. It was good to see some blood in these old movies. That's the thing I fear most is I'm not going to see blood. Mm. But I thought this was just blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I was excited, Kat. I had never heard of this, and when I looked it up, I was like, oh, Jack Nicholson did a six. Oh, Roger Corman. Oh, Boris Karloff.
Mm.
You know,
I
watched a bunch of Boris Karloff movies back late last year. The Criterion has that whole pre-code thing. Mm. Earlier, The Raven than the Corman Raven, 30s Raven, The Black Cat, 30s Black Cat with Lugosi and Karloff. Awesome movies. So I've kind of developed an affinity for some of those old guys that I wasn't as familiar with. He's very old. And I mean, this is the end of Boris Karloff, the beginning of Jack Nicholson. I feel like one thing about this week is that we've seen the beginning and end of Jack Nicholson. Here he is, fresh-faced, 25 years old. His tail is, you know, ready to go. He even directed, apparently Nicholson directed the last day of shoots on this movie, which I think there are five credited directors.
It was filmed over, like, I think several years.
Yeah, this was a total mess. And this is one that was very interesting to read about. Reading about the making of this movie, way more interesting
yes.
than watching this movie. When it started, I was like, oh, yes, this whole intro. I loved the cold open with the dungeon and the corpse and Karloff. And then that whole, like, animated kind of intro thing, super gothic. I was like, oh, this is going to be great. This is going to be late night, old-timey gothic horror. And even when it starts on the beach with Nicholson and the woman, Julia Knight, who was his wife at the time, intriguing, you know, and then just as every minute that goes by, you just get sort of bogged down. It gets slower and slower and slower until it's just scenes of people walking in rooms and out of rooms, entering, exiting, saying a bunch of stuff, talking about people you don't know what they're talking about, and then they just keep walking in and out of other rooms, and they just keep doing this over and over again until you don't know what the hell is going on. You don't care what's going on. What's going on is that every director shot a different script. Francis Ford Coppola.
Different sets.
Shot some of this, different sets. This was started, you mentioned Poe. This was at the end of Corman's Poe movies. He did a bunch of them. And they were finishing wrapping The Raven, which was financed. And he, real quick, he left it set up and started shooting this movie on his own dime just to get it in on The Raven set. Shot for 2 days with Karloff. And then from there, it went on, like you were saying, Kevin, for at least a year or more, different directors, different locations, shooting different scripts. Francis Ford Coppola was doing whatever he wanted. He was going over budget and over schedule even back then. And then eventually there were reshoots by Corman, all got pasted together into a bunch of nonsense. I have never been so glad, Dave, to see someone's eyes get picked out by a bird as I was the 50-minute mark. The bird comes down, pecks the guy's eyes out. I'm like, yes.
I don't need a reason. Just do it.
That was great. This is a really interesting oddity because of all the people involved and because of the crazy story behind it. Jack Nicholson has said they don't make movies like that anymore. And that's such a classic diplomatic Jack Nicholson line. He doesn't say he's glad or that. But he did. I did read that he said it was a ton of fun. He was young and gung-ho, and it was a crazy time. So this was an interesting one to check out. It's on Tubi.
And he was great in this movie.
Yeah.
With what little I assume he had to work with, you wouldn't have even known from his performance because he was just... Right off the bat. I don't know. I assume this wasn't his first movie, but...
Yeah, I'm not sure. It wasn't...
No, it wasn't his first. No. But
he's like, 25.
His first movie was in 58.
Okay.
That's what I read.
So long.
Because I was curious about that, too.
Yeah, this is before he has the whole... Before he's doing Jack Nicholson all the time. This is before the eyebrows, before the shaking the head. And
the bald.
I mean,
well, he kept some hair.
Full.
I know. He did have a full head. Yeah.
This is. Well, he had more hair jarring. In Wolf eventually.
Woo! But I will say that this one was one that I read. I had to read what was going on while the film was going on. And then in that moment, I was like, oh, okay. There's story here. You know?
It's a lesson in what you said, Trent. Okay, Jack Nicholson, Boris Karloff, Roger Corman. Why have I never heard of this?
Well,
it's because it sucks. It's not because it's some hidden away gem with a bunch of legends that are like, hey, no one tell anyone about that movie we made in 63. It's because it is this.
It's like the Texas Chainsaw movie with McConaughey and Zellweger.
Yeah, they probably like, don't talk about that a lot.
Yeah, you bury that.
It's good to see that Jack Nicholson got to be like young and handsome instead of like gruesome and demonic kind of looking how he is now. I think that he's now more way better of a villain.
I didn't realize that he retired in like 2010 or something.
Yeah, he's 86 now.
Yeah.
He's just on a yacht eating lasagna or something.
No, like the last thing I read, somebody called him up to be in a movie or something and he passed. I think Stern or somebody was interviewing, and they said, yeah, I talked to Jack, and he said he spent all day sitting under a tree reading a book.
There was a tabloid story last year about Nicholson, and it had pictures of him sitting on his back porch, and the whole thing was that he's totally out of it, doesn't know what's going on, wanders around the house. But then after that story, he did show up at a Lakers game. he went to some Lakers game after that, maybe to tamp down the speculation that he had lost. He seemed fine. I saw him at a couple games. He looked, you know, just like...
I mean, if I were observed, just walking around, walking around the house aimlessly, stared at the wall for a while.
Yeah, that's any day.
Is that... Well, there was that one story where he went to a Lakers game, but then they kicked him out because he, like, spilled his... He brought chili from home, and he, like, spilled his chili.
Good for him.
Yeah, I know.
Fucking guy's retired in his 80s. Like, he's had courtside seats for how many decades? Fuck this. Like, I'm going to eat my chili. Well,
I loved the score in this. Great score. Was it Ronald Stein?
We've talked about it, though. Like, okay. Les Baxter. We've talked about him before.
Okay,
he's the guy that's done, like, a million things, but there's all this controversy about how he couldn't even read music and write music and, like, totally stole everybody else's
shit. And he was plagiarizing a lot of music, supposedly.
Allegedly.
Well, it's great. I mean, that's probably the best part of the movie is the score.
Yeah, it's really good. It's very... Well, I think it's this movie... Because Corman was, like, shooting everything so bizarrely that I think Stein ended up with, like, a 90-piece orchestra at his disposal. But, I think it was, like, kind of like an over-tagging on to the end of something that was probably funded.
Yeah.
But the score in this is super legit.
And it does. I mean, it looks great. The sets are great. The castle is awesome. I love all the beach stuff. I love how some scenes the castle is drawn. They'll just... cut away to a drawing of the castle. There's some enjoyable things about this. I read that it was recut and re-released in France in 1991. The only box office information is about that French release in 91.
He did it because never copywrote this, so it was in the public domain.
Right.
So I think Dick Miller went back and did reshoots like years later, so like almost 30 years later. But presented like his part of the original movie as like a flashback or something.
Yeah.
But all it was is so that Corman could get the rights.
So they could get it back under copyright.
Probably in the 90s, probably looking at Nicholson going out and doing like Batman and, you know, all this crazy shit. It's like, I probably should get the rights to this locked up because it'll make some dough. The other misleading thing is the thumbnail on Tubi is super dope. It makes this movie look fucking awesome.
It does. Yeah. Who is the terror? My God.
Still don't know.
That looks cool. No clue.
I still don't know.
No clue who the terror is.
The film itself was the terror.
You know, I feel like I don't actually know who Roger Corman is because I'm looking at this body of work here and I don't recognize anything really.
We've talked about him a lot because everyone from James Cameron to Coppola to... anyone in horror of a certain era, of a certain generation, they all worked under Corman at one time or another. They all did jobs on all these low-budget horror movies and genre movies and stuff. But, yeah, this is the first actual Roger Corman-directed and produced movie that I believe that we've talked about.
So, well, Piranha.
Piranha
would be the big...
Okay,
so, I mean, that was so far ago. That was probably the longest, like... dialogue that we had on
Corman. I think of him as kind of a Charles Band figure, a prolific producer
like Fessenden would be kind of like a modern day Corman or something like.
Yeah. Okay, next up on Jack Nicholson, Not the Shining Week, talking about a movie from 1994 called Wolf.
Worn down and out of luck, aging publisher Will Randall is at the end of his rope when a younger coworker snatches his job out from under his nose. But after being bitten by a wolf, Will suddenly finds himself energized, more competitive than ever, and possessed with amazingly heightened senses. Meanwhile, the beautiful daughter of his shrewd boss begins to fall for him, without realizing that the man she's begun to love is gradually turning into the creature by which he was bitten. This was a fun film. It had Jack Nicholson in his prime, I would say, of the early 90s, with the early 90s vibes, accompanied by the perfect early 90s ensemble cast. It was an interesting character for Nicholson because he got to show like the before and after vibes of his role, being both like a pushover, mild-mannered guy versus a cutthroat wolf businessman. But both are very likable characters. And James Spader was somehow in his most likable and unlikable role simultaneously. I think I could watch young James Spader for forever. I was very into that.
Classic Spader.
Classic Spader. Very into that hair. I was, however, waiting for Michael Keaton to show up because I really wanted like the Batman trifecta to be completed with the Nicholson and Pfeiffer triangle. You know, Danny DeVito maybe could have shown up, but that would have made it too perfect of a film. Even though it starts off as more of a romance movie than a horror movie for a good while, which made I made Nick watch this movie with me, and even he was like, "Is this?" He did the thing. He's like, "Is this a horror movie?" I'm like, "Yes, Nick. It's a horror movie. It's fine for the podcast. Thank you so much for your input." But then as soon as the wolf transformation starts with Nicholson, it's on. Was the transformation a little goofy looking? Perhaps, yes. Was the deer biting moment a bit comical? Yes. Yes, it was. But I didn't hate it. Especially once you got to that final wolf scene and people are just like jumping and flying through the air to and fro. 10 out of 10. I thought the story was interesting. I thought it was fun to watch. Some parts were a little predictable, I would say, but there were some others that I didn't see coming, so that was fun. I thought it was well-paced, even though it was a good 2 hours long. It captivated my attention. It was exactly what I wanted and expected from this movie. Michelle Pfeiffer, so good, always, always and forever. She was great. I wish we could have seen her do some transforming. I think that would have really elevated this up a scotch. But yeah, I think there's still time for a sequel. So maybe her and Nicholson will come back and be little wolves together. I don't know. But I liked this movie a lot. So Trent, what did you think?
This is a real howler. I gotta apologize, Kat. I would take issue with nearly every single thing you just said.
Oh, heard. Love that. Love that for me.
You know, this is a very entertaining bad movie. Mm. I think of all the bad movies that we've seen plenty. This is a fun, it really is, it's compulsively watchable. I watched it twice, and I enjoyed every minute of it, even though it's very bad. Mm-hmm. I loved, you know, I never really put together lycanthropy was the original Viagra. And that's what this movie really illustrates. And I really like the idea of, you know, the werewolf as the midlife crisis tale of the man losing virility, facing the winter of his life. Mm. He's not only getting forced out of his job by his young protege, he's getting forced out of his wife by his young protege. I mean, this guy just couldn't be, you know, he's had his tail ripped off and he's gone off to die in the woods, but gets bitten by the werewolf and it's game on. Prime Jack Nicholson, to me, this is the end of Jack Nicholson.
I said prime 90s Jack Nicholson.
Prime 90s. Well, it's 94. Sure. So I would think, to me, this is the end. And if you look at his catalog, you know, he did some stuff after this, but he, to me, to my eyes, he, in this movie, Jack looks tired. He looks embarrassed. He seems confused about what he's doing in this movie and what this movie is. He just does not, to me, there's no twinkle, there's no vitality at all, which is ironic because he's trying to play this werewolf. He just looks lost, like, why am I here? He's trying to get the eyebrow raise going. He's trying to do some mugging, but it's just so fucking ridiculous, and it's such an indignity that by the time, okay, the deer kill, oh my God. He grabs a deer in Central Park. First of all, I do want to say, Jack Nicholson's stuntman in this should get a casting credit because he's in the movie. He's 100% in the movie chasing a deer through Central Park, which Jack Nicholson then grabs with little protest from the deer and bites on the neck and snaps his neck and kills. By the time you get to the point toward the end where Jack Nicholson is on all fours, there has been no transformation. What transformation? He looks like Wolverine from the X-Men. Nice. That's the only transformation that happens. Love He's it. On all fours in Central Park, barking and howling at the moon. Good night, Jack Nicholson. I'm glad he got The Departed. This was it for him. And this was it for the werewolf movie in Hollywood until Benicio del Toro as Wolfman, which also sucked. So, fun one, though.
Thanks. Hey, Dave, how's it going?
Good. This movie had big dick energy. I loved it. It was part of like this 90s corporate horror, like supernatural corporate, yeah. Like The Devil's Advocate and all those ones yeah, where they yeah. was like
oh,
a
good call.
It's like a business angle and like
yeah.
maybe your soul and all this stuff. I kind of have a, it's kind of a guilty pleasure of mine, this sort of thing. And I hadn't been smoking, so like the heightened sense of smell got me all like, I was like, oh, I'm like a werewolf now. And I was in Los Angeles. I was hearing all these like really like fuck that guy. I'll tell you what, we'll sign a contract next week. People like walking by me and shit in LA, and I'm just like, wow.
Yeah, you signed that contract.
This is pretty ridiculous, but you can't really look away.
Yeah.
And then the Jim Henson fucking final form of the werewolf what? Is beautiful, especially at the end. It's such a majestic ending.
Love it.
Michelle Pfeiffer had to spellbind us at the very end of it. That last scene must have been in her contract or something. I guess it's over.
I fucking loved this movie.
Woo!
And it's everything that everybody said. You will hate this movie. You have to catch this movie on a good day for you. And you can't go into it thinking about any other werewolf movies or any other horror movies. What you do is you go into this movie thinking about Jerry Maguire. And you will love this entire film.
Wow. Wow. Okay. Okay. I'm with you.
It's great. And I disagree with you, Trent. I don't think that Nicholson looks bored or tired or anything. I think that he and Spader had a fucking blast making this movie. And I guarantee you every time that the director said cut, those guys were off fucking high-fiving and being like, this is some ridiculous shit. Can you believe we're doing this? No. And that's exactly what I thought the entire time I was watching this movie. I don't think I'd ever seen this. I'd seen the ending for sure, the Spader-Nicholson like fight. But I probably like on a clip or just caught it like at the end of like a Cinemax night or something. But this is super fucking fun. And just like you, Dave, I have a real soft spot for like capitalistic angles on horror. Yeah. And I just think it's hilarious. At a time you had like lawyers, like Devil's Advocate was a great call. All this. You have a book publisher. So like all this movie kept reminding me of is Jerry Maguire and Elf. And I'm like, what is happening right now? Like, this is fucking brilliant. Like, you don't even need a werewolf. I would have watched a rom-com with Pfeiffer, Nicholson, and Spader all day long. Totally would have watched it.
Mm-hmm.
Probably would have thrown it up there with, like, Hanks and Meg Ryan. Mm-hmm. You know, like, this is just great.
Spader's squirm is so incredible.
The what?
His squirm.
Yeah. I did love Spader. Yeah.
Spader is, I would watch, yeah, and Cat. I mean, like, The Blacklist. Like, Spader is still slaying.
He's killing
it.
He's
so great. But I mean, I think all of that stuff, I kept catching myself watching these scenes in Nicholson's publishing office and watching the whole power dynamic. And that was a great call, Trent, like that this is sort of like a midlife crisis / like end of life crisis,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
sort of like a
beyond
transition
midlife.
Period.
Yeah.
I was captivated and I forgot that I was watching a werewolf movie at all, but I loved it.
Yeah,
I was like, well, yeah, take your secretary, take his fucking clients, go
yeah.
see that big boss in his mansion and tell him what's up.
Mm-hmm.
Steal his daughter. Yeah, fuck his daughter.
Yeah.
Do it, Nicholson.
Do it.
And then I'd be like, oh shit, there's a wolf too. Wow. Okay. I forgot about that. But I think a lot of the problem is this is classic 90s era filmmaking where they were probably a little bit scared because you didn't really probably have a lot of successful horror, like I think werewolf movies anyway, kind of a tricky subgenre.
And this is early 90s, so 94. It's kind of the horror boom is over at this
yeah.
point. Yeah.
And then also you had the writer of this was like an author who had done like Legends of the Fall. And not the movie, but like he was much more known for like as a playwright and an author.
Yeah.
And then you brought in Mike Nichols to direct this. Like, what the fuck kind of call was that? Roger
weird.
Corman should have directed this movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you bring in this guy that's done like, you know, The Birdcage and like a bunch
Nichols
of perfectly
has done a lot
great
of awesome
films.
Movies way better than this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
but not in this vein. So I think it was like tonally, it was definitely a little bit off. Yeah. And I did feel like, you know, they give like Jack Nicholson like kind of like this Adam Sandler vibe. Like, really? He's going to end up with Michelle Pfeiffer? Like every Sandler flick, you're like, really? That's your girlfriend? And in this one, I was like, really? Like, Michelle Pfeiffer is attracted to Jack Nicholson right now? Like, come on.
He's a werewolf. Like, he's got the vibe.
Yeah, true. I guess I didn't think about pheromones and shit like that. Hey, all that aside, I fucking loved this movie. You know what? I fucking bought it. Okay?
Woo! You bought the film, like physically, or
no.
Oh, okay, like the essence of the film. Oh, okay.
I was sad that he never bit the poor dying man.
That was kind of rude.
I laughed out loud at that scene. That's the only kind of like exposition you get in this. There's very little like werewolf lore, which I was appreciating.
Yeah.
And then you get a weird scene in a weird room with a weird guy. You get your exposition, and then he just sticks his hand in front of Nicholson's face. I burst out laughing. Like, what I would give to be in that situation.
He gets the amulet.
I would have bit the shit out of that guy.
I'm surprised you guys, both Kat and Kevin, mentioned the quote-unquote romance angle in this, which is the most underwritten, weirdest, no screen time, no chemistry romance I've ever seen. Let's talk about age gaps. 21 years. This is old Hollywood, baby. 21 year age gap. Nicholson was 56 in this movie. To my eyes, looks every day of it. It's all catching up with Jack. Seriously, I mean, he looks at least 56. Michelle Pfeiffer is 35, the most beautiful woman in the world. At this, you know, in 1994, there's nobody more beautiful than Michelle Pfeiffer, and it's so ridiculous and oogie, and I was so thankful for the cutaways. There's two love scenes in this. Quick cutaways, thank God. She's got him in handcuffs.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Nice. This is like watching your parents or something. Good Lord. Cut away.
I wasn't enthralled by the romance. I was just saying it existed.
It did exist. That's true.
Very nonchalant police work in this.
Oh, these they guys were so bad.
David Schwimmer.
Schwimmer
shows up as a beat cop, sure.
Yeah.
You mentioned the writing. This. Now, I read a few things about this. One, this was based on a novel, I believe. And
no, I don't think so.
Wasn't?
No, I think the guy that started out writing it, like I said, was more known as...
I thought I'd read that Nicholson was a good friend of the original writer and had agreed to do the movie because they were pals, and they brought in, they did definitely bring in Elaine May to punch up the script. She's got a, I never heard of her, but we've seen stuff that she's been involved in, long and prolific career in comedy. She came in later and did a bunch of stuff that I think was more comedy, because I think there are some very, very funny parts of this. I mean, when he pisses on James Spader's shoes at the urinal,
great.
It gives him, I'm just marking my territory thing. Some of that is intentional comedy, but it's such a mix of intentional and unintentional.
We should point out that Jack Nicholson's not actually here. That was Trent doing an impression.
I do love Mike Nichols, though. You mentioned the director. He made The Graduate, directed Catch-22, directed an awesome movie, I think it's 74, called Carnal Knowledge with Jack Nicholson, Art Garfunkel, and Candace Bergen. It's an incredible movie about masculinity and all the stuff that this movie is about, but a much better and younger version. He also directed Closer. You guys ever see that crazy movie?
Yeah. I've no idea.
Natalie Portman, Clive Owen, Jude Law, Julia Roberts. Mm-hmm. It's like a four-way constant.
I know of what you speak.
Really good. Birdcage, I think you mentioned Silkwood. So I think he's an interesting filmmaker that has made other movies that explore some of these same topics that are less comedic, I guess.
I mean, maybe this is what, 94 needed. You know, what was happening.
It definitely didn't need the pleats. This is another thing. I was wondering, like, who decided, when and why was it decided that this stage of American fashion, that men's business wear and formal wear should be big and baggy and bulky, everything should be oversized, and everything should be like pleated corduroy. He looks so fucking bad in these suits. Everyone just looks terrible.
I didn't know you were such a discerning Taylor.
I didn't either until I watched this movie. I was like, these guys look so bad.
Somebody needs a slim fit over here.
Somebody suit these guys.
Secure over here, man.
Trent, you're also forgetting the third writer.
Take some measurements.
That got most of the credit for this, and that's Wesley Strick.
Okay.
So Arachnophobia.
Okay.
Cape Fear.
This looks like Cape Fear.
And I think we've talked about him probably in the Cape Fear. He did the 2010 Nightmare on Elm Street remake.
Those animatronic wolves.
Circling back.
Yeah, Rick Baker. How did you... So this is another example of the terror where you have everybody involved in this movie from the score to the effects to everything are all incredibly accomplished.
Yeah. And the score is great. I did love the score.
Score's great, but like, why did you have Rick Baker? You could have hired me. I could have grabbed some yak hair... glued some shit on. Like,
that's worse.
I could go find contacts. I mean, they didn't have Amazon in 94, but like, I could have found some weird yellow contacts.
If there was a werewolf character in a Chuck E. Cheese band, that's what you're looking at. I thought it was Five Nights at Freddy's for me. Like, why am I looking at these terrible animatronic wolves? It reminds me of Cycle of the Werewolf. You guys seen that? We talked about that on the Patreon, I think. Gary Busey, the Stephen King werewolf movie,
wow,
where the werewolf looks like Smokey the Bear.
Silver Bullet?
Yeah, Silver Bullet. Oh, it was based on Cycle of the Werewolf was the short story,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I kind of like the goofy werewolf.
I think it just adds to the fun of the movie. It's just a fun movie.
You can't handle the tooth.
Stop.
Well, it's the 30th anniversary of this film this year.
Wow.
30 years old.
Oh, perfect. Like I said, maybe we'll get a sequel.
Good timing. Yeah.
Nicholson at a Lakers game or something.
Spilling chili.
Kiss Cam with Michelle Pfeiffer.
That's too Teen Wolf.
$70 million budget.
Whoa.
Well, yeah, look at every... If you read...
Where did it go?
If you read everyone involved...
Yeah, I guess it went to the payroll.
Yeah.
Went to the cast. $70 million did not get
cast,
spent on...
music.
Special effects.
Like,
yeah.
Ennio Morricone.
Didn't make it really. It made $130 million worldwide, but half of that was foreign. Only made like 66 domestic, made another 60-something. Foreign markets saved this from being a total bath.
This movie's far better than the Terror.
Far better. Oh, yeah. Absolutely no question about it.
I would rewatch this.
This is a fun, you know, that's a fun bad movie.
I own this movie.
I enjoy it. Dial it up on Cat's new TV.
Yeah, everyone come over and watch it. Way better on 85 inches.
I like that one of the powers of the werewolf is you keep outing people for drinking.
Yeah.
Seriously.
That's like one of the gags. They keep, you know, from 30 feet away, drinking tequila in the morning.
Yeah.
Oh, how did he know?
Yeah. And then it happens like, again. Talking later, he's like, yeah, you know, and he's like,
I put a little tequila in my coffee, and he was calling me out down the hall.
He's like, yeah, don't tell people that. You weren't even drinking coffee.
This is like
a something like
old white guy's fever dream. You know what I mean? It's like he's just like these things wouldn't fly. So he's like, dude, why are you bothering me? Yeah, I had a shot of tequila. Why are you looking at me from across
the
building and listening? Like,
detective, would you like another vodka tonic?
Oh, yeah. That was it.
Richard Jenkins. I mean, the cast just goes on for days. Richard Jenkins.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Greatest role ever, yeah. Cabin in the Woods.
I kind of had a hard time buying Nicholson as a doormat. You know, before he gets turned into the werewolf, he's like such a pushover and just doesn't, even his wife gets mad at him for not even protesting when James Spader has snatched his job out from under him. It was kind of hard for me to buy this, like, low energy, low confidence, pushover version of Jack Nicholson. It just doesn't really. But I mean, that's the point of the story. By the end, he's howling at the moon.
Back at the
going
moon.
To the zoo. He's at the zoo like he's grocery shopping, just looking through all the cages, like thinking of what animal he could munch on.
What's the one with Helen Hunt?
That is
as good as it gets.
Yes.
I think that was one of the couple notables that he did after this. This is after A Few Good Men.
Those are both scarier than the picks this week.
Okay, so he did As Good as It Gets after this. He did a couple actually really great lesser seen movies directed by Sean Penn, The Crossing Guard and The Pledge. Those are awesome.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Awesome late Nicholson movies.
Anger Management.
And of course, The Departed, maybe about Schmidt.
Say it correct.
The Departed.
The Departed.
The Departed.
Thank you.
So Kevin and I decided to watch The Raven from 63, which, as we discussed, the entire set of The Terror, except for the outdoor stuff, the interior set was from The Raven. And I knew that, but I kind of forgot the Jack Nicholson part. That Jack Nicholson was still hanging around from The Raven and talked him into doing The Terror. So again, with The Raven 63, you get young Jack Nicholson, which is interesting. I had never seen this one, and I enjoyed it. It's a comedy. I didn't realize, I guess, that The Raven 63, the Corman with Vincent Price, Jack Nicholson, and Karloff, again, is held over, or was held over for The Terror. I didn't realize it was a farcical comedy. So I was not ready. I started watching it. I love the gothic intro, and I really like that stuff. And then all of a sudden you have a talking raven. When the raven comes in and
comical.
The raven just starts speaking and he's doing like one liners. I was like, oh boy, you hadn't seen this.
It blew. I'd never seen this. I mean, I started the last episode by saying like, this is an era of film that is largely unexplored by me.
Right.
But what so this movie is ridiculous. It's super good. It's better than The Terror.
Yes.
But what it reminded me of, and why I do like going back, because how do I put this? Look behind me. The posters behind me right now are like Creature from the Black Lagoon,
nice.
The original Dracula. You're never going to know how those people felt when they watched those movies and found them terrifying.
Right.
Because even though we covered like Black Lagoon fairly recently, I suppose, in like the history of the show, I still love it and I can appreciate it, but I definitely don't find it scary. And none of that stuff is like scary to me.
No.
So these movies are interesting to me. Like when you did The Wolfman and then, you know, Cat brings in The Terror, we go back to The Raven. I was kind of expecting, okay, it's Corman, it's Price, it's Karloff. This is going to be spooky and it's going to be like this gothic tale. It's going to be eerie.
It's Edgar Allan Poe, for God's sake.
Poe. I was not expecting to burst out laughing when the raven starts talking. And also I wasn't expecting like kind of how trippy it started out, like more like the colors and like some of the art and things like that. But this is why I love going back to these things, because so like the Creature from the Black Lagoon at one time was scary for a whole generation of people. This raven, this version of the raven to me, it probably was like an introduction to horror movies and gothic tales to kids back in the 60s. And this would totally have been like a Monster Squad or Gremlins. Like, it's like one of these like gateway drugs into horror, because it's super silly. It's way more geared towards kids, in my opinion. You've got like sorcerers running around and stuff like that. But it does have like some relatively heavy material. There is a little bit of an attempt to make this like gothic and horror-ish.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed this one. And then just like The Terror, this one is way more fun to like learn about and like forget about the raven itself. There's so much that I was able to explore in the few days since we last recorded about just Corman's entire like Poe cycle that interested me. And there's some great like just recaps on YouTube of stuff that people can just like, they can save you a couple hours of like internet searching with like a good 35 minute YouTube video. But the first thing I noticed, I pull up like the wiki for The Raven and I'm like, all right, like so I watched it. It was fun. Let's figure this out. The screenplay is written by Richard Matheson.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all right, so this has got to be a different Richard Matheson, but he's highlighted on Wikipedia. So he's got a page. Let me click on that. I'm like, it is. It's the fucking guy that wrote I Am Legend. He wrote the script for this. Like my mind was blown.
I
Am Legend is one of my favorite pieces of literature ever. I love it. I think it's fucking brilliant. Matheson's done a ton of other great shit. Like, I guess I'm going to say more modern. I'm going to date myself. Like Stir of Echoes, the Kevin Bacon flick. You know, Matheson is kind of a legend and not a ton. No, but I was like, how did they get him like writing these weird like AIP Corman Poe movies?
Well, that's funny. Yeah, because there's a quote from him, from the screenwriter, he said when they told me they wanted to adapt a movie from the poem, The Raven is not even a short story. It's a poem. And the movie starts, one of my favorite parts of the movie, is at the beginning you have Vincent Price reading a portion of the poem, which is really cool and sets a tone that changes as soon as The Raven shows up. But the screenwriter said when they told me they wanted to adapt the poem, I thought it was the most ridiculous thing I ever heard. And so the only thing I could think of was we're going to just go comedy with this.
Yeah. And it does, I mean, and clearly they do. Now, another interesting thing to of this one, because we talked in The Terror about how Nicholson's really good, despite, like, you know, the fact that, you know, the movie doesn't have a script and it's just like all over the fucking place. Nicholson is really good in The Terror. He's horrible in The Raven. Like, I couldn't believe how much of like a throwaway side character he was.
Well,
you get a lot more like Nicholson, probably because he was like, he wasn't Karloff, and obviously Price hopped on a fucking plane and got out of there. So he probably had a little bit more like time on his hands and probably less like restriction on what he could do. But in The Raven, he is just like the total side piece. Like, there's, he doesn't really get any of the Nicholson. Obviously you get very little of that in The Terror as well, but you get nothing in The Raven.
That's funny, because I was thinking kind of the opposite. I was impressed, and I felt stupid being impressed by this, but I was, when you see him on screen, now it's such a similar milieu to The Terror, I was impressed that it's a totally different character than The Terror. Jack Nicholson plays it totally different. It's not the same thing at all. So even though it looks like the same thing, we know that it's the same set, and we know this, The Terror was jammed in on a weekend, or most of it, the original photography anyway. I'm just kind of expecting the same thing. And it was, to me, it was kind of like a duh moment. They're actors. Jack Nicholson, pretty good actor. And I thought that this really illustrated that, you know, these are two totally different roles and he plays them totally differently. It's not the guy from The Terror. It's the kind of bumbling son of this sorcerer, whatever you want to call him, alchemist. I kind of liked that. I was like, oh, acting. Oh, that's how they do it.
Yeah,
they
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. Especially knowing that they were like back to back. But I think the biggest thing for me watching, because I watched House of Usher, and then some of them are a little bit more difficult to find, or you got to like rent them or sign up for some bullshit thing that I wasn't already signed up for. I wasn't going to do that. So I watched like some clips and trailers. And like I said, like I found a few really cool recaps of like the entire Corman era and how like the whole poll cycle came to be.
Right.
But what I really found myself thinking about is like, we are largely like children of the 80s, and so a lot of our shows, particularly when we pick a movie that warrants discussion, is about like the practical effects, because we grew up in a time where people were really figuring out and like swinging for the fences on practical effects.
It was a golden
era.
Obviously,
yeah, and then we sort of like grew into this era of you know, CGI and watch like the digital age sort of grow. Watching these movies, what it made me realize is that back then you didn't have access to any of that. So like, you have to watch these movies and realize like practical effects weren't really a thing, because this is the 60s. It was still very much taboo to be showing blood and showing guts and things like that. So nobody was really even tinkering with that. And so what Corman was doing, and I think what you have to watch these, and I think we even talked about it in The Wolfman particularly, it's set design. So everything was like set design and color palettes. And what these movies kept doing to me was like, and I think maybe I'll have to do some more research, but I think some of the things that Corman probably like cut his teeth on in terms of like making a name for himself was these set designs are so killer. If you keep going back, like The Raven, House of Usher, like all of these, and it is hilarious to know that some of them are the exact same sets and just like redressed,
but they
like expanded it a little bit.
That's okay. That's what I was thinking. They redressed it well, because I was paying close attention. Okay, this is the same set as The Terror, but they did a nice job making it look like a different set.
Yeah, and back then a lot of things were done on sound stages or very like closed sets. They had to build right. this shit. You know, they couldn't just go green screen something and boom, you're at Hogwarts, right. Harry. So to, like what I started to appreciate is like when I go back and watch these films now, like I'm really looking at set design and things like that, because that to me is sort of the equivalent of like 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s of a 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, like practical gore effects and things like that.
Yeah, I was one of the most interesting things to me was the same idea. I was really interested in thinking about how physically how the movie was made throughout when they're the final duel, when they're floating in the chairs. And I read about how much Boris Karloff hated being, they were on wires. And so then you start thinking, oh, now, wait a minute, these guys are on wires and they're on these big chairs. So then you think, well, so these chairs are just made of nothing. These chairs are like paper, but they look really good. They look like heavy chairs, but they can't because these guys are flying around. And reading about how much Karloff hated that, how much Vincent Price hated the snake around his neck. So the whole way through, just like you say, I'm looking at how good everything looks, and even like the corpses, and it just really, it feels so authentic to have so little to work with, and to make something that looks so good. And the effects are, you know, pretty convincing. They're flying, you know, it's no Harry Potter, but they're off the ground, and it, you know, you buy it. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, and we haven't even gotten to Vincent Price. I mean, not just The Raven, but going like House of Usher, he's in almost all of the other Corman Poe movies, except yeah. for The Terror.
Yeah.
He's so fucked. Like, House of Usher is legit.
Love him. I love that movie.
In terms of, like, that's an actual gothic tale. It's done very well. It has some really good and interesting and not campy twists and turns. I mean, that has been adapted a billion times.
Yeah.
But Price is so good in that. And he's even really good in The Raven. He's a much lighter Vincent Price. Like,
it's the, a camp.
The comedy is very yeah. light. And
it's the campy Price.
Yeah, but he's so good. Like, what a just an absolute fucking legend.
Yes.
Like, I could watch him in anything.
Yeah, he just has a vibe. It's so unique, and we know it so well, as it's almost like there's almost a comfort. It's like being at your grandparents' house or something when you're a kid. You know, you got Vincent yeah. Price here, and he's kind of, he's mugging, and Peter Lorre, who plays Doctor whatever, one of the other sorcerers here that was originally yeah. turned into the Raven. I'm not going to say that I really have a iron grip on every plot twist in this, because it just is not honestly that interesting. You don't really care. You're just watching that stuff. But I read that, you know, Peter Lorre was doing a lot of ad-libbing, and Vincent Price didn't love it, but went along with it. And Boris Karloff had a really hard time with it. But you can see Price is just, he's so smooth that nothing is going to throw this guy off too much. And I wanted to hear you talk about House of Usher, because I don't even remember why, but sometime over the past winter, I watched The Fall of the House of Usher 60 or 61, Roger Corman with Vincent Price, and I watched The Pit and the Pendulum also. And I thought Fall of the House of Usher was so good. That was, like you said, legit dark gothic old. I really was like, not just like The Raven, where it's kind of an oddity and you're having fun and yeah, appreciating yeah. it. I thought it was a really good horror movie.
It's fantastic. And I mean, I'm coming super fresh off of Mike Flanagan's
right.
Fall of the House of Usher on Netflix right. that blew me away. I'm a huge fan of Flanagan. I've said that. And I think that show, oh, so good. Yeah, this shocked me. Again, the script was written by Richard Matheson.
He wrote Usher as well.
Yeah, so this, okay. I went with this one. I knew I was going to probably be able to like grab one more other than The Raven. And I was like, well, Matheson wrote Usher too. I'm super curious to see if he does this as campy and as weird as The Raven. No, this is like really legit. There's some actual like scary moments. There's appropriate like old timey acting, kind of like Vincent Price at his best, I guess.
Yep. Yep.
And the sets in this, which are not just recycled sets from The Raven, The Terror, like whatever, the sets are great. Les yeah. Baxter, we've talked about him, like music. I thought the music was super great, regardless of who actually did it. I thought all of it was just really, really good. That one, completely different movie and different story. They don't have similarities in terms of like their guts, but like it reminded me of like the Wolfman in terms of like, damn, this is how you make a movie and you keep people engaged, not just by the story and the acting and the script, but like the entire environment and the world that Corman created with this movie is fantastic.
That's a great point, and I totally agree. It's almost fresh to see somebody make something where there's really no tricks. They can't grab you with digital effects. They can't grab you with elaborate action scenes. They're not grabbing you with the latest hot star Hollywood stars of the day. Yes, sure, Vincent Price was a star. Yes, but it's really comes down to storytelling and old style acting. And the acting didn't even, you know, sometimes we see older stuff. You got that transatlantic accent thing going on and that, you know, that kind of old Hollywood style of acting, which is so much more effective than what you expect these days. But that did not bother me at all with Usher. I just was really impressed that they could do something so engaging with so little. And I've always have, you know, we've talked about it before. When you go back and you watch this old timey stuff, if you're kind of hesitant, but I would highly recommend it. I'd like to delve a little bit more into Corman's catalog. You can't miss. I think Usher is. It's on Tubi.
Good question.
I think it's
on Tubi.
It's out there. I don't think I rented it. I think I saw it for free. But I would highly recommend Usher. It's not just an oddity. It's actually a really good movie.
Yeah, I don't. I think I had to rent it. Hold
okay,
on.
Maybe I'm wrong. I also watched The Pit and the Pendulum with Price, and I liked that one a lot too. But it was very similar. They kind of, you know, when we say Poe adaptations, all of these Poe adaptations are very loose. They kind of take a kernel of the idea, The Black Cat. They take a kernel and they just do whatever with it. I liked The Pit and the Pendulum, but I watched it after Usher, and it was so similar. They kind of both were about they both had very similar storylines, and the wardrobe was a little bit more annoying in Pendulum. Vincent Price has this like I don't know, is this the fluffy thing like around his neck the whole time. It's very distracting in 2024 to look at somebody, you know, dressed like this. But that was pretty good too, and also I thought it was interesting that, you know, going back to The Raven and all these movies, really. But Karloff, this is Karloff's like third round of this shit, because I watched a while back, I watched The Raven from the 30s, the pre-code Raven, was Karloff and Bela Lugosi. And it's yet another totally crazy interpretation of The Raven. It's very straight played. It's very dark, way darker than I think any of these. But that was really good too. Highly recommend the 30s Raven and also the 30s Black Cat. I liked even more. Also Karloff and Lugosi. Those are, you can go even back further than these and find some really good movies.
Yeah, I think the deal with Usher is that one made a lot of money at the time.
Yeah.
And I think Pit and the Pendulum was like that your classic, what happens when you're like working with a film production and distribution organization and you make a surprise hit. It's no different than horror is now.
Repeat success.
I mean, yeah, just do it. Again. Just like keep doing it. So I haven't seen the Pit and the Pendulum, yeah. But it wouldn't surprise me if they're like, well, we did this and everyone liked it. So let's not stray too far. Like we've got, yeah. You know, but sometimes like the initial magic really is lightning in a bottle and you can recreate everything except for that. Yeah. But yeah, I think Corman overall, forget just about like the Poe era, he's had so many wild eras in his career.
Yeah.
Like a beach party era where he was making like all these beach party movies. Right. And like who the fuck is this guy? Like we've talked about him, like we know everything about him, but I actually think he is a name that it gets thrown around a lot. And yes. I bet that there's a very small percentage of people that could actually sit down and like actually hold like an educated conversation about Roger Corman. I'm not one of them. I aspire to be now, but I'm definitely somebody that's thrown his name around like I'm a fucking expert on him. And I'm like, my mind is blown.
Yeah.
To just what I'm learning.
It was such a blue collar thing back in those days. You know, making movies was a lot different. And a lot of these guys that we talk about, because younger filmmakers worked under them, like Corman. I just watched a couple of Lucio Fulci movies. And he's a guy that, or we talked about Mario Bava before. You look at the catalog, yes, there's a ton of giallo. Yes, there's a ton of gory horror later. But there's also eras where he was just doing totally different genre movies. He was doing westerns. He was doing sword and sandals. He was doing whatever was hot at the time. So it's very workmanlike. It's very like production. Okay, we got to crank these movies out. They're doing 2-3 movies a year. It's really interesting and very different from how I think of movies being made today.
Well, anything that we watch is better than The Terror. So it was a low bar. And again, I mean, I'll stand by the fact that The Terror, it is super fun. It's good.
We had to cleanse our palate. Like, we had to cleanse our palates after The Terror.
Yeah, but like, you know, I think I compared it to like, you know, a band walking in after like the Ramones had recorded. Well, I needed to go back and see if Corman made any Ramones records.
Yeah, exactly.
And he did.
Exactly,
he did, you know.
Yeah,
throw Vincent. Not that Vincent Price was the only missing piece, because I'm not disparaging Nicholson, Karloff, anybody that was involved in The Terror, but you know, you can tell even more now that the Terror was probably a well-earned experiment for like Corman and some folks to do, but just not the best idea to now have.
Yeah,
you know.
I think we mentioned, I don't remember if we mentioned that Corman was trying to make his own Poe movie, basically. And I think we can see now the difference between, even if you veer dramatically from the source material, even if you just take the title, do some of a poem, and then go crazy with it, I think we can see now the difference between having some kind of substantial source material and then go off, between, you know, the difference between that and something like The Terror, which was just from scratch, literally from scratch, just making it up as they go along. You can definitely see the difference now that we've seen more.
We've got a long ways to go, but we'll get there.
Next week, we're going to be talking about Hostel Part 2 from 2007. That's free on Pluto or Plex right now on VOD. Also going to be talking about Terrifier 2 from 2022. That's free with ads on Vudu. It's on Screambox or VOD.